Welcome to Me and Mary Jane with your host, Patricia A. Patton.
So hello everyone, and welcome to Me and Mary Jane. This is our second season where our focus is on conversations with people who are smarter than me. And so today our conversation is with Dan Watkins, the New Jersey hemp farmer. But we're gonna get into that. Hi Dan, how are you?
Hey Patricia, good, how are you today?
I'm good. I have spent some time trying to understand how to make this the most useful conversation for our listeners. Because I'm starting at a space of really not knowing anything. But, you know, I'm feeling a little better now. I'm starting to get a groundwork for understanding and having like a conversation I think that's meaningful. And in this case, We are talking with the award-winning economist, Dan Watkins. And what the reason I bring that up, because I don't normally start with that about, you know, this is who this person is and that's why. But I think it is important for listeners to understand how your background informs what you do today and that there are lessons embedded in that. It may not be exactly replicable for others, but for me, I think there are things in there that people tell you in conversation at conferences and all that don't make a lot of sense. So I think your experience is helpful in understanding how you brought your experience to bear in this environment. So let's begin there. And what is it that you actually do?
So I'm kind of a retired banker and current farmer. That's what I do. What I did for 20 something years is worked in the financial markets. So started with financial advisor, financial planner, helping people with their retirements and annuities and mutual funds and things like that. Then the technology boom happened late 90s, early 2000. And I got into technology. I got into telecommunications, actually, was the first part. Working with the stock exchanges, where people were on the phone yelling at each other, buy this, buy that. Things are traded in fractions of a dollar. This is 99, 2000 kind of deal. 9/11 happened, September 11th happened, and the world recalibrated how it communicated. From yelling at each other on the phone or in front of each other to going digital and electronic. And when all that happened, the economy as we know it went digital. And we all see that now in Bitcoin and things like that. And what I was responsible for over the next 10, 15, 20 years was putting that technology in place to let banks and traders and investors get better data, better information, manage risk, predict the future, and look at all these different things in terms of currency and politics, market conditions. And it's funny because I never thought that I would go into farming, but towards the later part of my career, I was a senior manager at Moody's, and Moody's job is to help governments, banks, people understand what is that risk, what the different markets look like. So for example, let's say you're in real estate. As everyone knows, in real estate, it's about location, location, location. You could do the same thing in the auto business or in the computer manufacturing business. So every business has a rating or a risk or a market cap. And what I found about almost 10 years ago was that agriculture and farming is the United States' biggest business by far. It is our gross domestic product. And it is so important for the United States to trade and promote and to grow farms for food, obviously, but also for things like ethanol, right? So corn is now part of our natural gas and clean energy initiative. Ethanol can still be a little expensive, but it's clean, right? But that's part of agriculture. The other thing is soy, right? So you don't really eat soybeans, but soy is in all of our products as a food additive or a preservative kind of thing. And all that has to do with trade and financing and people's businesses and retail and this whole supply chain, which doesn't seem so sexy, but it's humongous. And cannabis popped up. And actually, I'm wearing my first company hat called Fawcett Farms. And I'm actually at Fawcett Farms right now in New Jersey in Sussex County. We're from Hudson County. Green Cell and Soul Cell, I'll tell you about that, is in Bergen County. And we have a lease in Morris County. And I'll tell you more about the companies, but essentially we have farming and cannabis focus all throughout the northern part of New Jersey, from New York to Pennsylvania and the border of New York. But anyway, I'm saying all that because when cannabis came out, we started looking at the risk, the infrastructure, and started to realize very fast that if it has THC in it and is considered marijuana, it's federally regulated. It's regulated by the pharmaceutical industry, regulated by the tobacco, regulated by the DEA. That's a real expensive proposition. But this little thing that people didn't really want to talk about, but if you look at all the underlying metrics of cannabis and all the money and all the investment, all the infrastructure and all the future is around hemp. And hemp, I don't know how many hundreds of years ago, 100 years ago before prohibition,
A thousand BC to, I looked that up. It was like 1000 BC to 1930. Like there you have the history of hemp being used in everything, which of course most of us didn't even think about, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, where I was going was.
Where?
Hemp was a mandatory crop for United States or American farmers to have. You had to pay, as a farmer, your taxes in hemp.
Oh, really?
Yes. The original money was made out of hemp. Clothing was made out of hemp. I'm a former Navy guy. You know, I didn't really work on a ship. I was more on the underwater special forces kind of thing. But ships use rope, right? To this day. Carhartt, for example, construction clothes. Hemp is stronger than denim, stronger than cotton, healthier than cotton, easier to grow than cotton, doesn't require pesticides like cotton. And hemp was a part of our major industrial infrastructure when it came to clothing and things like that. We didn't really look at it from the medicinal side so much, but again, that's agriculture, right? So just think about clothing, for example. We just talked about cotton. Everything that we wear is cotton. Even if it has silk in it, it probably has a little cotton in it, right? You have to grow that. You have to grow the cotton. That's agriculture. Maybe take another perspective. I don't know. Slavery.
Don't go there.
Well, I'm going to go there because slavery, right?
Enslavement.
Okay, good one. Enslavement. Actually, in the car, I guess I'm stuck. Talking to the president of Fawcett Farms. Mr. Frankie Fawcett.
How we doing, guys?
Hello.
How are you?
Try to get him involved a little bit.
I was looking for the link.
We're working. So why was slavery so important to the United States? Because of the cotton trade. If you look at what gold and Bitcoin and everything is worth today, cotton was the gold back then. And so the country was built on agriculture. Now, in terms of slavery, We did really well because we had cheap labor and we stole that from people, right? But the plantation owners, they actually robbed other people from jobs. And so after the slavery ended and prohibition ended, what was left were landowners like the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and the Goldmans and the Lehmans and all these people who bought all this land And you can see it today with Bill Gates and Bezos. They're buying all this land for what? For farming. So you don't hear about that all the time because, you know, it's how the big guys and the secret societies and all that stuff have made their business, but it's actually very, very real. One of the largest banks in the world is China Agricultural Bank. They're probably 4 to 5 largest banks in the world. I'm talking $2 to $3 trillion in assets. China doesn't grow anything. They trade it, right? So agriculture, whether it's for food, for medicine, for clothes, for industry, is essential to the underpinning of most governments, underpinning of most economies. Brazil is another good example. They cut down rainforests to grow farms and things like that. So anyway, so I looked into farming and I looked at hemp over cannabis because it's easier to become a hemp farmer than a marijuana. I mean, I'm going to use the word marijuana because that's what the government uses, a marijuana cultivator.
So, all right. So I'm going back to your initial premise, which was that in your job as an economist, what you did was look to ways that you could avoid problems, how you could mitigate problems and identify opportunities. So that's where I'm looking now. So you, at some point, discover that there's an opportunity in hemp farming when the whole shift toward cannabis legalization begins to come in. How long ago was that?
So 2017, Governor Murphy gets elected, says he's going to expand the medical marijuana business in New Jersey. And down in Ocean County, where you are, a couple of the senators down there said, we'd like to do hemp. And New Jersey sat on the hemp regulations as they pushed towards the medical marijuana stuff. And that's when I saw the opportunity. And how I looked at it was simple. Just like in the stock market, here's something maybe a lot of people don't know. If there's 10 people trading a stock, whoever gets the best price, they win. So for every 10 traders, 1 wins, 9 loses. In options, it's 2 to 8. In commodities, it's 7, right? And it goes on and on and on down the line. Everybody rushed towards marijuana. Everybody, thousands of companies from all over the place coming to New Jersey. They were only giving out 7 licenses. So that means there's 1,000 people going into this business, but only 7 are going to win. That's a risk I didn't want to take. I mean, I left my job to get into this business, and I wanted a place where I wouldn't have to compete with other people. I wouldn't have to get into this lottery of, you know, who gets what and who's the best. And no, right? There are farms all over New Jersey that aren't being farmed. I have to look after my family. Other people need to look after their families. Some people have backgrounds that they're not comfortable with to get a medical marijuana license or recreational marijuana license or anything. So the opportunity became clear that there's more need and more opportunity for more people to get into farming, whether it be for hemp or for food. But hemp, and we could talk about that, hemp has tremendous amount of value, way over recreational or medical cannabis, by tenfold. They just don't tell you that because it's attached to all these other businesses like makeup and clothes and medicine and CBD and all these other things. So I realized I have less competition. I realized that I can work within my community. I realized I could work with the federal government, with the state, with the IRS, to enable myself to be a farmer. Okay. And with that is kind of where we've been working for the last couple of years.
Okay, so one of the things that you pointed out to me was that the thing that makes that possible also is that it's hemp is DEA approved, FDA approved, and USDA approved.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So with what you just said, You took the advantage of your community, less competition, you know, in terms of the business piece of it. And for me, what I'm trying to look at, because of course I couldn't see this before, You have more of what I described as like, you know, you can look from, you can take an aerial view of kind of what's possible. Whereas most of us who know little about, I mean, I know something about gardening. I probably could farm a little bit, you know?
Of course.
Yeah, but it never occurred to me to even begin to think about that as a possibility or where in there, because what we are being marketed in conversations about this is white labeling CBD, you know, just really blowing smoke up somebody else's ass, really. You know, there's really no way for me specifically to do what you did, like to bring my prior experience into this industry. And that's really what I want you to help people understand.
Sure.
This is how to kind of think about it in a different way. I mean, it's not that there aren't conferences or seminars that you could pay for to go to try and figure out something in the course of 3 or 4 hours, but they don't really address the specifics of how you implement the thing. They tell you what, but they don't tell you how.
Right. Right. So let me think about how to. So when somebody goes for a loan at a bank, when you establish a new company, you have to fill out a couple different kinds of forms. One is, what type of company are you? And, or what kind of loan are you asking for? And then what do you do with the money once you have it, right? And the reason I'm saying that is because there's an encyclopedia of codes. They're called NAICS and USAIC codes, right? And how do you categorize yourself as a cannabis company? You really can't. It doesn't exist.
Oh, I got you.
But you can categorize yourself as an agricultural company, right? And then once you do that, the services you provide would be food services, food packaging, food delivery, whatever, right? So as soon as hemp started, well, let me take a step back in terms of the regulations, because you mentioned the regulations.
Yeah.
So a law firm at the time, Fawcett Farms, we're working at Wendell's Marks, right? And they try to explain to us, this is 2018, early 2018, how cannabis is regulated by the DEA and the FDA as a drug. And so it looks more like it's pharmaceutical. And go, wait a second. And then all of a sudden, the DEA in May 2018 basically has a correspondence, public information. Look up DEA, FDA letter, May 2018. The DEA basically says, we don't believe CBD is a drug. To the FDA, what do you guys think? FDA goes, yeah, we see great success with how CBD is able to help people as young as babies. Yeah. The reason why that's important is because 3 months later, or 4 months later, in September. Sorry?
No, 3 months later, what happens is that GW Pharma and the US government bring their product in.
Bring their product in. The first time a cannabis product has FDA approval, and to give it to babies was for CBD.
Right.
Wow. That's a signal to me that there's another opportunity in cannabis outside of everybody wants to have their own dispensary. Everybody wants to have babies. So what about older people with Alzheimer's? What about people who have addiction issues? What about animals? None of these people can take THC without medical clearance, right? And there hasn't really been any DEA, FDA saying, sure, THC. It's always a therapeutic discussion, right?
Right.
So basically, after Epidiolex got the FDA approval, I think they made $228 million in one day, GW Pharma, on their stock increase. I think it hit like 220, it's down to 100 now, so they lost half, which is something else I wanted to talk about. 4 months later, Curaleaf, which is actually my favorite cannabis company. I don't like many cannabis companies in terms of stock because a lot of it has to do with the value of their real estate, not how much weed they sell. If you look at all these guys, Acreage, ArcView, Canopy, all of them, MedMen, when you go into their balance sheet, like when you go to a bank, what kind of company are you? Where are your assets? Where's your value? How's your stock so big? It's all based on their real estate. Oh, you have 50 buildings in 50 states with a $5 million building. Okay, you're worth $2.5 billion. That's exactly how the cannabis companies have been, I'll say it, I don't care. It's exactly how the cannabis companies have been running game on the average investor by overinflating their value, which had nothing to do with their business. They weren't selling anything. It was all real estate. So Curaleaf, which is my favorite, right? They've done a very good job. They deliver to patients. They set up stuff. They bring people in. They work with the government in all types of ways. They met with CVS 2019 and made a huge announcement. We're going to put CBD, CVS candies out there. CVS is the largest pharma retail over-the-counter. Wait a second. You're saying, so CBD is deregulated? It's publicly traded? It is. Now, I should go a step back. In September, I didn't know hemp was cannabis. I remember I'm a new farmer. I had no idea hemp was cannabis. Somebody tells me, oh yeah, it's sativa L.
But no people, I mean, most people don't. I mean, everybody with this whole thing about 0.3 or it's a cousin, there are all these code words to the fact that hemp and cannabis are fundamentally the same thing.
That's right. No, they're exactly the same thing. Cannabis is a species. Or in the family of
Chemovar.
It's not a cultivar, no. The cultivar would be the strain types. Okay. So cannabis is part of the genus Canicae. So I think it's a species. I get it wrong all the time, right? Who cares? So you got the Canicae, which has a few other types of plants. You have cannabis, which has three species: sativa, indica, ruderalis. And then you have cultivars, which are expressions of those three species. So I thought hemp was a fourth species. Why are they calling it this plant and calling everything else, which gets you high, cannabis? Wrong. The definition of marijuana versus hemp is 0.3% more THC. That's it. It is the exact same fucking plant. Excuse me. But it's the same plant. So wait a second. Why are people jumping to hemp? They want to get into cannabis. They want to grow cannabis, right? They want to sell cannabis. Why wouldn't you get into hemp? It's the same plant. They're not telling anyone. but they did tell, and they do work with farmers. They do work with people who grow food, who remediate soil, who grow things for energy efficiency, who grow things for nutrition, who grow things for clothes and fabric. The farming industry knows very, very well. And so Cornell, I was following Cornell studies more. Cornell's really advanced in cannabis market studies, market reporting, revenues. And in 2016, they had a pie chart that said the hemp business in the United States was about $1 billion. Like, oh, really? There aren't even any, I didn't even know there are hemp companies involved. Yes, there have been. So for example, when you look at this chart back in 2006, I think you hear some numbers go back and forth about cannabis. Oh, it's going to be 35 billion. It's going to be 10 billion. It's 20. It's about 25 to 30 billion right now. It has nothing to do with marijuana. No, this is now. I think we're probably going to hit $20 billion this year globally with hemp and CBD. So all the money in marijuana is all inflated against the company stocks. Nothing to do with the revenue. And people talk about like Colorado, for example. Oh, Colorado does really well. They make all this money. No, they don't. A lot of people spend their money on creating cannabis companies. And Colorado takes track of that. Well, this guy bought a farm. This guy bought this. This one has this retail store. And this one got $1 million investments. But at the end of the day, the sales and the tax on those sales have nothing to do with the forecasts of the size of the business, right? So like New Jersey, for example, we have now we have 14 dispensaries. We have 95,000 cards in the system, even though we're recreational now. You may not need the card anymore. We have 9 million people in New Jersey. Do you know that maybe 1.2 to 1.5, at least 25 to 30% of people in New Jersey smoke weed? I do. I never got a card.
Yeah.
So there's 1 million people in the system that are being told to go through this one little conduit 95,000 cards out there. Thank you guys for all the cards and all the support that you've done, and the legislation. I got a little shout out to Black Cannabis and Phil Dume and the marijuana associations that pushed to get cannabis regulation into the hands of people who need it, like veterans and things like that. But as a business, it's so tight and so overblown.
So how do we explain or understand all of the, you know, rigmarole that's going on between the MSOs and the stateside businesses, or this traffic of people? I don't want to call anybody out, but, you know, going to Canada to have a relationship with a company and then coming back and listing themselves on the New York Stock Exchange, or, you know, I mean, I follow a few farms in Canada. I don't know anything about any of this. You know, it's all, so, you know, it's all gambling, you know, for me, straight gambling, because I know nothing really.
Right. But
I wonder if those people are the ones who are the actual, are they the myth makers, or are they the actual business people that are just setting up for when adult use is legal across the country?
Great question. And I would say at a high level, I call all of that liquidity. Liquidity, and you heard of this last Reddit thing and the trick, right? Liquidity just means that there's more money in the system. And that allows for people to benefit and for legislation to happen, right? All that's liquidity. Like, to your point, in the future, when it becomes recreational or adult use, is the infrastructure going to be there? Who's going to invest in it? Right now, yeah, Canada is great. Canopy, those guys, right? Even MDX in Atlantic City, right? In 2018, we applied. Foster Farms Corporation, still alive, and now there's new Foster Farms Holdings LLC. I'm an owner. I'm the registered agent, financial guy. I also own Soul Cell and Green Cell, and Green Cell majority of the umbrella of these other companies, to explain a little. But in 2018, when we looked at the application, a lot of it had to do with, where's your current experience, right?
Yeah.
And so this was medical in this last application. Yeah, I would love to sell weed, right? Personally, no, me, not me. Why? Because I have friends and family and, you know, Jamaica and Mexico are all a part of the underground, or should it be underground? It should all be legal to me. You should be able to have it as far as I'm concerned, and you shouldn't have to buy it from a certain place. So I stay out of that for that reason, philosophically. But on the other side, you literally have to be all these different things, and you have to show that you know how to do it. So we wouldn't have any dispensaries in New Jersey if it was up to New Jersey people to make them, because we don't know how to grow anything in New Jersey. We're not allowed to. So Canada came in, Colorado came in. I think Ewing Breakwater is part of the dispensary guys out on the West Coast. They know what they're doing. They know what they're doing. So they invested in New Jersey, okay? They brought their know-how from other states. So I think that's very important. And I think New Jersey was also smart and not just handing out licenses all the time, even though our general counsel would argue, because he's appealing that we didn't get our license. Why should we get one? We never grew weed before in a medical environment. And so we don't deserve to have that. Now, the other guys, what they did is, again, back to investing in the industry. They actually set up companies in New Jersey. So you take Curaleaf, for example, or I think outside of Garden State and maybe Harmony, these are independent, self-started companies. But all the other dispensaries would set up a new LLC in New Jersey, put somebody on payroll, start kicking out, you know, jobs and paying taxes and filing for leases and all the things that you have to do to have a real business operation. So when time to apply, they could say they're a New Jersey-based company, because the way the marijuana dispensary rules work in New Jersey, whether it's the old program or the new program, they want the company to be owned 75% by a New Jersey entity, right? So when Canada comes in, they come in and they establish a New Jersey-based entity. You could do the same thing with hemp. When you think about it, you say, okay, if I want a hemp permit, where do I want one? Do I want one in Colorado if I'm only going to be selling to people in Colorado? Or do I want one in New Jersey where I can sell to people in New Jersey? And so that's where the opportunity was, is still humongous, people. It's humongous because there's 9 million people in New Jersey. We have a USDA federal hemp program, which means for $300, somebody can go get their hemp license and now compete in New Jersey as a New Jersey-based company. I'm sorry, Colorado and Washington State and Oregon. Our New Jersey hemp, you know, is for New Jersey consumers. You can sell your hemp in New Jersey, right? You can bring it in now or CBD, but that benefits your state. We have to take care of our state. You have to take care of your state. Everybody has to take care of their community. So it kind of goes back to this philosophy of farming, community, feeding people, educating people, people that you can touch, people that are close to you, people that know you, people that know your family, people that know people that may not be in a good circumstance and are looking for help. You got to go close. You got to stay in community. So that's where farming is traditionally really, really good. And if you look at New Jersey, we can't feed ourselves. So we're importing food like crazy. And that cost us a lot of money. If we had to do that with cannabis, everybody would be happy. I mean, I love my stuff from California every time I go. And if you look at California, cannabis products are extremely cheap because there's 100,000 of them there doing it. Right. So, and the more surplus supply demand, the more supply, the less demand. So New Jersey is still an opportunity for cannabis and for hemp. It's just that when it comes to the THC side, it's going to take forever. And it's such a small, narrow business. I the people who make money in that business are investing in themselves and they're investing in real estate. They're not going to give you any equity because that's their money.
So we have about 6 minutes. And what I want to do in this 6 minutes, because there's other stuff we have to get to, but to tie up this segment, I want you to focus our minds on the actual day-to-day of what a hemp farmer would do. Because, okay, we could get a license, that $300, but then what kind of real work is involved in farming? Yeah. I know from you and our earlier conversations that growing hemp is not year round. So, you know, you have to figure out what else you're gonna do, how you're gonna put something together, or it can be year round, depending upon whether you have land and you have a greenhouse and all these other things. So we're gonna get to the other businesses that are supportive, are part of what you do, but tell me what a farmer actually has to do.
Okay, so in a couple minutes, there are two, I look at farming in two ways, the old way and the new or future way. The old way is you got a bunch of land, turn it over.
Oh yeah.
You turn the soil, you plant, okay? The new way is you protect the crops indoors and you grow what you can grow. So let's talk about the first way. When you have a lot of acreage, you get a lot of material. You have a lot of material, right? There's not a lot of acreage in New Jersey. That's the first thing. And it's very expensive. The second thing is you have to compete with the environment. Before you even get started with selling anything, you have to compete with rain. You have to compete with spillage of the rain and the snow left over and what's in the soil before you even put anything in the soil. So now that limits your ability to grow something to the optimal time that you can plant. That's the harvest, that's your cultivation harvest season. New Jersey is not too bad. It's about May into October. Go to Vermont, it's June into September.
Oh.
Right? So you have these different metrics. So what does a day-to-day farmer do on the outdoor? Is they're dealing with the environment. They're dealing with pests. They're dealing with mold. They're dealing with, you know, fertilization, all these things. It's very, very difficult. It's very, very hard work. It's like if you take care of your own garden and lawn, you know how it is when you got a little piece of thing like that. If you're growing people's food and medicine, it's extremely difficult. So New Jersey used to be the farming capital of the country. In fact, Rutgers is still in the top 10. We grew a lot of the food for the country in terms of genetics, and how we did it is the new way, in greenhouses. So when I learned how to be a farmer up in Vermont, stepping in cow shit and all this other stuff, people had greenhouses. Why? Because you can grow little things in greenhouses, little things that you can eat, little things that are protected from the environment, little things that you can plant at any time because they're in pots. Little things that anybody can deal with because you don't have to drive tractors. You don't have to deal with chemicals. You're walking around and playing with the plants and somebody can teach you what to do and how to do it. And so the greenhouse business is all year long. You can grow food in Alaska in an igloo in a greenhouse. That's how Canada is so advanced. That's why they're so good at cannabis, right? Cannabis, because they know how to grow indoors. So the day-to-day operations for a traditional farmer is what you might think. Tractors and horses and plows, limited amount of time. And I'll just say this, most farmers, most of the people in the country who are poor, when I say most, I mean the amount of people who are on welfare, 65 to 70% of them live in rural farmland. So it doesn't pay to be a farmer. Of course, the richest people in the world own food distribution. So go figure, right? 7-Eleven, CVS sells food, Kroger's, Publix, Unilever, Procter & Gamble, all these companies. On the sales side, it's huge agriculture, right? So you gotta look at the difference. In a greenhouse, you can grow so much food, flowers, cannabis, and you control the environment. So there's an old saying, maybe a new saying, an old saying for me, because I have my 3 years of farming experience. Inside of a greenhouse, you're God. You control the weather, you control the genetics, you control the environment, and all you have to do is follow the instructions. So the day-to-day in a greenhouse is, after the greenhouse is built, water, nutrients, turn on the lights, turn off the lights, make sure the heat is working. Pretty much anybody can do it.
What do you mean when you say you control the genetics? What do you mean when you say that?
So let's use cannabis. I'll continue to use cannabis as an example. To me, my favorite cannabis region is Oregon. I think for some reason, the environment in Oregon, whether it's the land, whether it's the air, whether it's the right amount of moisture and dryness, beautiful, right? So you see an amazing strain in Oregon. And you want to grow that on the East Coast. So you take the seeds from the farmer in Oregon and you plant it in your beautiful cultivated ground in New Jersey. The plant doesn't grow right. The genetics don't keep the same because the environment is different. Right. You do it in a greenhouse. You ask the farmer who owns the genetics, what kind of soil should I use? What kind of nutrients? What's the air temperature? How should I treat it with water? And if you do that right, you should be able to replicate the environment of Oregon or wherever it grew naturally in the wild, sort of like you control the genetics. And you could do this with a lot of things. Like we have a pretty interesting guy in New Jersey. A lot of people know him. His name is Ken Vandervied. He has Hillview Med, TerraSend, I think. I'm not sure, a couple of others. But his family are basil farmers. You say basil, so why? You know, they actually do the genetics on most of the basil sold in the United States. They're amazing. These types of farmers, they're in Morris County, New Jersey. They never put basil in the ground, but many people go to them to get those genetics in little pots and little starters, and then they grow their own basil in their own place. Right? When you go to Lowe's or Home Depot, or Trader Joe's, and you get your tomato plants and your basil plants, those are already started. Those are they came from a greenhouse.
Right.
They came from a greenhouse. Last year, we had a couple companies that were part of Greens. Everything changes every year, but Greenline is an agricultural company out of Pennsylvania. They have like seven other companies. They've been around for about 7-10 years. They do everything from lettuce and sunflowers and strawberry and celery, all indoors in downtown Philadelphia. They do it with hydroponics out in Lancaster. And they were part of the genetics program. They helped me build Green Cell, so Green Line and Soul Cell got together. And then we became part of the genetics program in New Jersey. One of our other members, Anthony, is a traditional farmer. He does all the things that I just told you by himself, right? He's driving around. He has butternut squash and tomatoes and basil and watermelons, busting his ass 3 months out of the year. The other 9 months, collecting a check. We put 40,000 hemp plants in his ground last year. Now, we did that outdoors. It was tricky. It wasn't very difficult because the soil was amazing. But at the end of the day, there were bugs and things on it, right? So we had to treat it like biomass. We had to treat it like a soy crop, less of a smoke flower crop. So
I don't know what that means.
So biomass, you melt it down. You melt it down, you make oil. Smoke flower, you smoke it, you put it in your mouth, right? So you don't want to, I mean, I don't want to say this, but you really don't want to put things in your mouth that someone grew outdoors and you don't know exactly what the conditions are outdoors. You don't know if there's, you know, mites on it or there's contamination in the soil. That's why COAs are very important. But when it comes from a greenhouse, you better believe that shit is good. Okay. Cause you know, it's already being protected from the environment. So that's why Colorado does so well. Colorado's all indoors. That's why people, when they buy cannabis, hey, where did it come from? Outdoor, backyard boogie. All right. You know, this is indoor, light depth, right? Dispensary grade, because the environment is controlled, which means that it's protecting the patient, the user, the consumer from anything harmful. So that's the opportunity in New Jersey, is that we can all have greenhouses literally in our backyards, at a friend's backyard, and 2,000 square feet can probably do hundreds, if not thousands of pounds of hemp, of basil, of arugula, of spinach, and make a lot of money for people. And it's never going to go away. People have to eat.
So good job. Like, I was interested. Oh, I was interested for the complete half an hour. So I'm sure my listeners will be as well. So I'm going to, I'd like to have a part two. We're going to wind this up as part one. I think that you definitely, you know, set the bar high in terms of being smarter than me on this subject. And I think that it will be a great precursor to, again, trying to help people understand how you actually set this belief system, this philosophy, this experience into real life. You know,
I would love that. I would love that.
I'm talking to Dan Watkins, the New Jersey hemp farmer, AKA veteran biologist, economist. what did I forget? I forgot something. But
Jack of all trades, master of none. Okay.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure. So we're going to, yeah. I'll be in touch with you to set up second go round.
Yeah. I just want to say one thing real quick.
Sure.
Why would I be interested? And other people knowing, my partner's here, and sometimes like, you know, so I believe in, there's two kinds of economic theories. One is the game theory. He who has the gold wins. Yeah. That doesn't work for everybody. The one that actually does work, invented right here in Princeton, New Jersey by economist John Nash, is equilibrium. Hey. When everybody eats, we all grow.
Yeah. Well, I definitely believe that you go further in community, you know?
That's right.
It takes a village, right?
It takes a village, right? If people are left behind and other people are benefiting, then we all kind of the middle loses, right? If everybody's able to participate, if everybody's able to carry their weight, if everybody's able to eat, then we all grow together, almost like a pyramid.
Yeah, I definitely believe that.
All right.
I will be in touch. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's a wrap. Thank you for joining us today. Pass the word. Share the love. Like, subscribe, tell a friend. Can't wait to talk to you again on the next episode. Thank you.